Okay, good afternoon. I'm Terry Gill for the appellants in this case. First, apologize for a severe cough, but I will do my best to keep it to a minimum. I apologize in advance if I fail at that. I first want to start off, this case isn't about the evidence or purported evidence of wrongdoing by the parties, whether my clients did something bad or whether they did not do something bad. That's not the appeal in this case. The appeal in this case is whether the court erred in instructing the jury on awarding economic damages, whether the court erred in instructing the jury on the award of punitive damages, and whether the court took appropriate action by disregarding the jury's verdict with regard to allocation of fault and making its own findings based upon its own questions. Those are the issues here. The primary point that's the basis for at least the first argument is what was the evidence of damages? There was a single piece of evidence, and it was undisputed, at least at the time of the trial, what that evidence was. It was the value of 20% of the company, 5% for Mr. Stewart, 15% for Mr. Waters, of their 20% interest in Dodge.
Without a minority discount.
Pardon?
Without a minority discount.
Without a minority discount. They're claiming they are entitled to the 20% of net sales proceeds that was distributed into the reserve account that was established by the court for the purpose that if they prevailed, they were entitled to those proceeds.
You're not really objecting to that.
We are not objecting to it. We are not contesting. The important fact here is that the plaintiffs offered evidence, and the only evidence was that they are entitled to the 20% net sales proceeds. And they referred, and their evidence of what that was reference to that account. How much was in the account? And they used the number 3.5. The parties concede or stipulate now that it's in fact 3.7. And the parties also concede that the court gave them that 3.7. They have it already. And that was money that was not Mr. Banbury's, not Group's. It was sitting in an account for the court to determine who gets it, based upon who owns DocuVault. The plaintiffs said that, and they pointed out why they're entitled to it. Mr. Waters, in his own testimony in the record, says, I'm entitled to it because there is no buy-sell agreement. Didn't exist. That means I own 20% of DocuVault, 15 and 5. And as a result, I get that money. That was his testimony. In the jury instruction conference about the fraud damage instruction, we objected to any instruction that would award damages based upon a fraud, based upon the fact that this was a rescission case. They were seeking rescission of that contract based upon fraud.
You're suggesting there was a contract that they needed to rescind.
That was our contention, that there was a contract. The jury...
And the jury disagreed with you.
The jury disagreed. The jury said that there, not that it was rescinded based upon fraud, rather, there was just no contract. Now, remember in the instructions, there was a meeting of the minds instruction, and the jury apparently determined that there was no agreement. There was no contract. So that's end of story. They went to the point of basically disregarding the question of whether the contract was procured by fraud, because they reasonably decided there's no contract, we don't have to decide that.
Wasn't there a claim in the nature of a derivative claim that the management personnel sort of mishandled this business and abused it?
Oh, absolutely. The plaintiffs had alleged all of those in their direct claim, maybe a dozen or maybe two dozen different allegations of wrongdoing, wrongful distributions to Group and Banbury, conflicts of interest. All of those claims were dismissed as direct claims. The court permitted them to be alleged as derivative claims. There was a separate derivative claim brought and a jury instruction the jury found for the defense. on all of the derivative claims. So because of that, none of the conduct that's discussed in the derivative claim can form a basis of liability in a direct claim, because the direct claim was limited to the contract, whether Waters and Stewart lost their membership interests through fraud or breach of fiduciary duty. They no longer are owners, so that they needed to be compensated. The jury said they didn't lose it. The court's judgment said they not only did not lose it, but that rendered them continuing owners. They lost nothing. And if they lost nothing, the jury could not have compensated them for that loss. If there's no other evidence of damages with respect to the direct claim, there is no basis for a damage award.
Mr. Gill, let me ask you, so the jury award of damages, was that taken from the escrow account that was set aside?
No. What happened was that the court entered judgment against Mr. Banbury and Docuval Group personally. And then, following the trial and judgment, the plaintiff said, since we're owners of DocuVault, we should get that 20% too. And the court said, well, you are owners of DocuVault, which, you know, the judgment says they are, and so you get that $3.7 million, which the company distributed to them. Now, the company was not a party to this case. So as members of DocuVault, they received the benefit of their ownership in the company. But at the same time, we point out the inconsistency of this in our briefs, the jury said, we'll award you damages with respect to those interests anyway. So what you have is cake and eating it too. You get to keep your ownership interest and obtain all the benefits of it, but you get damages as if you lost the interests, and therefore you get damages as a result of that.
Not approximately equal.
And an amount, the jury picked out a number that is hard to explain, frankly. The plaintiffs suggest that it's 20% of $28 million. But again, that's a number that was never offered by the plaintiffs as a basis for damages. It is sitting in a document that was a non-binding document that wasn't even between the parties. The actual documents relating to the sale were never introduced into evidence. And the parties agreed as to what the net proceeds, the net value of this were. So how they came to that number is beyond us. But what we do know is there's no evidence to support such a number. And more than that, there's no basis for awarding it at all, because there's simply no damages when you rescind a contract and they remain the owners. We cited the Hilti case, similar kind of situation, where a contract to sell a hotel was rescinded. The plaintiff got damages, reversed by the Court of Appeals, saying, you don't get damages if it's rescinded, you get to keep the hotel. Same thing here. You don't get damages if the contract was never enforced and you lost your hotel or your interest. You instead get to keep your hotel or interest. The punitives are, we believe, is a simpler problem. It is a pure, simple legal error for the court to have granted a motion to amend at the close of evidence. Such motions are subject to Rule 15B of the Rules of Civil Procedure, not 15A. And Rule 15B states that you can only do that, you can only grant such a motion, if the claim that was tried was expressly or impliedly consented to. Plenty of cases saying if you object to the claim, it's not consented to expressly or impliedly. Here there's more evidence of objection to this claim that you could possibly imagine, given the circumstances.
Most of the objections are pretrial.
There are pretrial objections, but remember, three objections prior, and they're all granted. The plaintiff specifically asked, let's reserve the issue to trial. The court said, no, I'm not reserving it to trial. Then they file a post-motion, post-evidence motion that says we should get it. And the court didn't even address the issue of whether it was consented to. And there's no evidence of consent.
But under that rule, isn't the consent occurs during the trial? In other words, the evidence comes in without objection, sufficient to form a basis for the claim. And because of that, it's consented to. Not pretrial, maybe all kinds of objections.
With respect, that's not the law. The law is simply the fact that evidence was introduced at trial which could support this claim is not enough to establish implied or express consent. And that's the VLN Corp versus American Office Equipment case, is that that's not enough, particularly when you have a situation where that evidence was relevant to other issues. The plaintiffs say, well, that's evidence of wrongful and willful conduct. No, that's not evidence, that's a legal argument. It was also evidence of intent to deceive. It was evidence of breach of fiduciary duty. It was evidence of all sorts of things. So it would not have been, any objection would not have been sustained anyway because it was relevant to the case in chief that was actually tried. And the cases, and there are many cases that say simply the fact that the evidence was in the case is not enough to establish consent. The other issue we address is the court's unilateral, it's hard to describe what it is, but essentially the disregard of the jury verdict.
Reallocation of fault, adding a person and joint and several liability.
Yes. So basically the question before the jury was, how do you allocate fault? Do you allocate it? The question actually listed Group Banbury and Mr. Banbury Sr. There was no line item for Banbury. The jury then allocated 100% to Group. What the court did, there's simply no legal basis for what the court did. I was thinking about this yesterday. The court essentially tried to treat it as a JNOV question. Could you reverse the jury and enter judgment notwithstanding the verdict? The court didn't do that. It didn't take the jury's choice and reverse it to its alternative. It made up a new choice and didn't ask, in which the jury wasn't even asked. So that is not a JNOV question. Obviously, this is not a clerical error question. Changing a judgment from zero to $5 or $9 million is material. It can't be that. Finally, could it be a motion for new trial? Nobody brought it as a motion for a new trial, but conceivably, if the court had found no reasonable jury could reach this conclusion, you could grant a new trial. We in our briefs, we talk about the evidence that it would be reasonable to find Group entirely liable. Group was the one who owned DocuVault. DocuVault was the one that created the escrow account. There's no evidence that Bowen had the money, Mr. Banbury. So there is a reasonable basis. But even if there was not a reasonable basis, the only remedy available to the court would be a new trial. It would not be able to just switch things around on its own accord, making its own factual determinations on questions never presented to the jury. If I may, Your Honor, I have 56 seconds. I'd like to reserve that.
Give you a whole minute.
A whole minute? Thank you, Your Honor.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court. I'm Kathleen Craigmile, and I appear on behalf of the plaintiffs in this case, Gary Waters and David Stewart. My attorney registration number is 24525. Mr. Gill skipped over and basically said this appeal is not about any wrongdoing that was done to the plaintiffs in this case. That couldn't be farther from the truth. The operating agreement in this case prescribes very clear fiduciary duties, including the highest fiduciary duty and loyalty from each member to the other members. and a fiduciary duty from the manager of the company, Bowen Banbury, directly to Mr. Waters and Mr. Stewart. More importantly, the Colorado Supreme Court in the Van Scott Holdings versus Van Scott case has imposed even more explicit fiduciary duties that apply in exactly the context that was involved in this case. First, the Colorado Supreme Court said that the controlling owners and officers of a company have a fiduciary obligation to act with an extreme measure of candor, unselfishness, and good faith in relation to the other owners of the company. And that is even enhanced in the context of a closed corporation or closed entity, which we have here. The Van Scott case also holds that controlling owners and officers of a company cannot attempt to purchase a minority owner's interest without fully disclosing all material facts and circumstances that surround or affect the proposed transaction. By their appeal in this case, Mr. Banbury and DocuVault Group, who were found liable by the jury for fraud and breach of fiduciary duty, are seeking to evade all liability and all damages that were caused by their harm.
Were those claims not brought as derivative claims?
The plaintiffs always asserted that they were individually harmed by defendants' actions, and their claims were always focused on individual harms.
What was their measure of damage?
The measure of damage was the distributions to which they were entitled, but defendants, acting in complete control of the company, failed to make to them after the company's assets were sold. But
they've got those now.
No, what they received was it ultimately ended up being $3.7 million that was held in an escrow account that was only set forth because the plaintiffs were forced to go to court and ask the trial judge to set up an escrow to protect their interests. That wasn't done by defendants voluntarily. That the trial court recognized was an offset of plaintiffs' damages. In this case, the company's assets.
What is the measure of, I'll go back to my question, what is the measure of damage? And what evidence is there in the record of that measure of damage?
The measure of damages is the distributions to which they were entitled and not paid. Mr. Banbury paid himself $10 million in cash out of the company's assets.
They've been paid that now.
They
got a judgment in that amount, regardless of whether they've been paid it. They have a judgment in that amount.
They have a judgment in an economic damages amount of $5.6 million between the two of them. That equates to 20% of $28 million. The plaintiffs did suggest at trial that an appropriate measure of damages, because they had no access to the information about what liabilities came out of the asset sale, would be what Mr. Banbury had testified was put in the escrow account. The jury has the ability to do this. If there was evidence in the record, the jury could ignore what the plaintiffs asked for and award more, so long as there was evidence in the record. There was evidence in the record that the upfront payment for the assets of the company in May 2008 was $28 million. As the trial court concluded in its order denying post-judgment motions, there was evidence that Mr. Banbury, after the asset sale, distributed immediately to himself $10 million of cash, failed to distribute to the plaintiffs a single dime, even though the minimum to which they could have been entitled was about $1.6 million, and thereafter used company assets to further his own interests in the litigation. Specifically, he took $2.8 million of company funds to pay company attorneys and his own attorneys.
I understand all that, but what is the measure of damage for that? Is there no measure of damage? The jury can just do what they wish? Just non-economic damage for pain and suffering and that sort of thing?
The jury awarded non-economic damages. The jury took the $28 million. There were two ways
the jury did award a non-economic damage?
They awarded, I believe, $150,000 to Mr. Waters and $50,000 to Mr. Stewart. In non-economic damages. In economic damages, they awarded a total of $5.6 million, which equated to 20% of $28 million. They could have reached that economic damages award in two ways. One, they could have concluded that Mr. Banbury, there's law that says that once there is money that can be considered damages, the defendant has the obligation to put forth evidence of the offset to that amount. He didn't put forth any evidence of liabilities that could be properly taken out of the $28 million. So the jury could have concluded that the entire $28 million upfront payment, not the entire payment, was distributable to plaintiffs. Mr. Banbury himself took out $10 million in cash and used $2.8 million in company funds to pay his own attorneys and company attorneys to support his interests, not plaintiffs' interests. So the jury could have concluded that the plaintiffs were damaged basically in the proportionate amount that Mr. Banbury took out of the company in cash and attorney's fees.
Ms. Craig-Mile, please clarify for me then, because my understanding is Mr. Gill said there were no documents in the record about the sale.
There were not a tremendous amount of documents in the record on the sale. There was the handwritten note, which was a key piece of evidence in the case. Basically, Mr. Banbury concealed his efforts to sell the company and concealed the actual agreement with Iron Mountain to sell the company for a total of $31.1 million. Plaintiffs, our clients, did not discover the sale, even though they'd asked Mr. Banbury for the specific questions, are you trying to sell the company, refused to answer that question. We found that information buried in handwritten notes in the accountant's files produced pursuant to a subpoena. The exhibit is referenced in the record. $31 million total sale, $28 million upfront payment. There was also a letter of intent that was introduced into evidence that disclosed the $28 million upfront payment and the total purchase price.
I'm assuming that Mr. Danbury acted horribly. I'm assuming that he acted fraudulently. I'm assuming that it's outrageous conduct. I'm assuming it's breach of fiduciary duty. I'm assuming all of those things. You need not go through them again. What is the measure? Your clients own 20% of the company. You have not alleged that the company diminished in value because of Mr. Barbary's conduct. So your clients own 20% of the company. They got that the proceeds from the sale of the company equal to 20%.
They didn't. They got, based on a court order that was made after the company requested direction from the court as to what to do with this escrow account, they got a portion of their economic damages, $3.7 million of the $5.6 million the jury awarded.
There was they got $3.8 million, which is 20. What is 20% of $28,000?
20% of $28 million is $5.6 million. That's what the jury awarded. They got $3.7 million.
But they're owed the balance.
They're owed the balance. They're owed non-economic damages. They're owed punitive damages. And if I could move to the punitive damages issue, unless you have any other questions about the economic damages. Mr. Gillis has mischaracterized the record in this case. Before trial, plaintiffs filed a motion to amend in April 2008, in which they set forth a prima facie case of fraud and breach of fiduciary duty and entitlement to punitive damages. That was deferred until August of 2008 because the trial judge said, finish discovery or do enough to discovery so that you're able to plead these things. In August 2008, plaintiffs pled a claim of punitive damages, which was accepted by the court for a year. On June 16th, 2009, approximately a month and a half before trial, Judge Mullins, who was no longer on the case, issued dispositive rulings in this case and cases involving Mr. Banbury's parents. He paradoxically found that the plaintiffs had established genuine issues as to their fraud claim and their fraud claim, but dismissed large portions of the complaint, including the punitive damages claim. Those two rulings were inconsistent because the standard for proving punitive damages is conduct that's attended by circumstances of fraud. So we always had a fraud claim going into trial. We moved to reconsider. Judge Lemon declined at that time to reconsider that order of Judge Mullins. We moved towards trial. In the trial management order that defendants signed off on, plaintiffs stated, we anticipate moving at trial to add a claim for punitive damages. In the jury instruction submitted, we anticipate moving a trial to assert a claim of punitive damages. Same thing in the verdict form. At trial, at the close of evidence, we filed our motion, as everyone anticipated, and defendant's counsel never argued any prejudice to this request for addition of punitive damages. The record's very clear. It's set out in our brief. We concede that punitive damages has always been a part of plaintiff's case. And then their only argument was that the plaintiffs didn't put on enough evidence to show fraud or willful or wanton, so that there wasn't sufficient evidence to support it. There was never any assertion of prejudice. If I could move briefly to the verdict form issue, that argument fails basically for three reasons. The only plausible reading of the verdict form in its entirety, the jury instructions in their entirety, is that the jury specifically found that both Group and Mr. Banbury were liable for fraud, both had breached fiduciary duties, the elements of both of those claims involve causing damages. The jury.
But those fiduciary duties to the company or to the?
To the individual.
To the individual owners.
The jury also concluded that both defendants were liable for punitive damages. And the standard in the jury instruction for awarding punitive damages is willful, wanton, fraudulent conduct in causing the plaintiff's damages. They found Mr. Banbury essentially 90% liable for the punitive damages, and the award against Group was much more. If you look at the verdict forms that defendants themselves proposed, they always proposed, both before and even at the closing of trial, that there never would be any allocation of fault as between DocuVault Group and Bowen Banbury. If there was an award against them, it would be a joint and several award, and that's what they proposed before trial, it's what they proposed at the close of trial. And now, seizing on a clerical error by the court, they're arguing that the jury could not have possibly reached that conclusion. If an issue, a factual issue such as allocation of fault, is omitted from a verdict form, then the trial court becomes a finder of fact, and that finding can be overturned only on an abuse of discretion. This is exactly what the defendants proposed, joint several liability. They can't go back now and argue that only Group was liable or that the verdict was inconsistent. This court and trial court had the obligation to try and make the verdict form consistent, and the only way to do it, reading the question, which is taking as 100% the combined fault of DocuVault Group and Bowen Banbury and Brooke Banbury, what was the percentage of fault for each? Clearly found no fault attributed to Brooke Banbury, the father, and 100% as to DocuVault Group with the omitted and Bowen Banbury. So we assert that that's a non-issue. Finally, on Mr. Waters and Mr. Stewart's cross appeal, it's a very simple issue. The Colorado Supreme Court in the Bernard versus Farmers Insurance Exchange has said that in breach of fiduciary duty cases, an award of attorney's fees is proper if it's necessary to make the injured plaintiff whole. In that case, there was an insurer involved, and so the court found we're not going to impose attorney's fees here because there's only a quasi-fiduciary duty. In this case, there are the clearest possible fiduciary duties between the members of DocuVault and under the Van Schaik case. And in this case, the jury specifically found that an element of the harm that my client suffered was legal fees. The jury wrote on the verdict form plus $1 million of legal fees. The trial court declined to include that amount in the judgment. But as the Supreme Court has held, in a fiduciary duty case where the plaintiff has expended attorney's fees and an award of fees is necessary to make the plaintiff whole, those fees should be awarded. We ask that the decision of the trial court or the orders of the trial court be affirmed on all bases except for on the issue of attorney's fees on the fiduciary duty claim. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. I think you have 1 minute, Counsel.
I'm glad to use my time judiciously, no pun intended.
Quickly, the issue about attorney's fees. There was dicta in that Supreme Court case. It wasn't necessary to the result. The Anstein case sets out the law in this state about whether what kind of cases it's appropriate to shift the attorney's fees. Trust cases made it very clear that the trust cases were the only cases in which you could exercise your discretion as a trial judge to shift them, not standard business fiduciary duty cases. There is no legal basis to shift attorney's fees in this case. Second, even if there were, and you want to decide to change the law, you have to find an abuse of discretion. There was a plenty of reason for the trial court, based on this record, to deny attorney's fees. There was plenty of wrongdoing on each side. There were secret agreements. There were all sorts of, there was false testimony in the case. So the court had a very reasonable basis to deny attorney's fees in this case. And in conclusion, we asked the court to enter, to reverse the verdict and judgment, enter judgment in favor of Group and Banbury in its entirety. Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
We thank both counsel for their briefs and arguments. The case will be deemed submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.